3, 2. One more time. Welcome to Hungry Magazine Culinary Podcasting. All of our podcasts can be found at www.hungrymag.com. This week we sat down with Sean McLean at Custom House in Chicago's Printer's Row neighborhood. Sean McLean is the chef partner at Spring, Green Zebra, and Custom House. All of Chef McLean's restaurants have received critical and national acclaim. Chef McLean has received Best New Restaurant honors from Bon Appetit. He was named Chef of the Year by Esquire magazine and one of 40 Under 40 to watch by Crain Chicago Business. He's also been nominated by the James Beard Foundation for Best Chef Midwest. We started out talking about the state of food criticism.
There's kind of a line between good and bad content, too. I mean, I think people will just come to the restaurant and be like, you know, I had Sean's avocado panna cotta, it was good, you know, whereas, you know, examining where that came from, and, you know, I think, so that's what...
Well, if they say it's good, I'll take it.
Yeah.
Because it gets a lot worse, man. Oh, it's unbelievable. See, even Metro Mix, which is just, at sometimes criminal, you know what I mean? The allowance of people, you know, obviously it's a free country, people ought to say, but you know, there's a point where it's constructive, whether it's criticism, whether it's just downright mean and evil, you know, I mean, people get bitter, you know, about, you know, it's like, Jesus, we're a restaurant, you know, come on, you know, it's like we, you know.
Well, I think they, you know, it's like teachers or whatever, what they say about teachers, I think the same goes for some writers and critics is, you know, they're the folks who can't do, so in some ways they want to tear down, you know, whatever it is. So you're from San Diego?
I was born in San Diego, son of a Navy doctor, so we moved around quite a bit. I went from San Diego to Spain, spent some time in Spain, and then my dad was originally from Cincinnati, so he... found a small town called Oxford, Ohio, where Miami University is, so we grew up in that town, and he was a physician, so he started his practice there, and spent most of my childhood, formidable years there, and moved to Chicago in 88 to come to culinary school. I was transferring from Miami of Ohio, so... And thought I would be here a couple of years, and that was 88, and I'm still here, so.
How did you decide to make that shift to culinary school?
You know, I've got a pretty vague memory of most of my high school and early college years. And, you know, I did as many drugs as the next guy, not more nor less, but I don't know why I can't remember. And that transition time, originally I had planned on going to California. You know, it was kind of like the surfer attitude. I'm going to just go out there and go to school and who knows what happens. And that didn't work out. I ended up working at a restaurant and was going to Miami, Ohio at the time. And I ended up spending 3 years at the restaurant. The restaurant was a very simple one of the main restaurants in town. Family style, steaks, ribs, chicken, you know, very, very elementary for the most part, cooking. But I excelled at it, you know, and I, you know, within a year was kind of running the kitchen at, you know, age 19, and great, I mean, look back, but it was something I was spending a lot of time and doing, felt like I was doing well, and my studies in Miami were not going well, so there was a conversation, and different people take credit for it, but I had different conversations with some friends, and my dad, and the subject came up, and it was something I never even considered, and someone just brought it up, and I thought, I'll go look, and I ended up I did a two-week program at Johnson & Wales, just to kind of get a, and I like that. Then I went to San Francisco's the CCA, had an interview there, liked it okay, my dad wasn't thrilled about paying for San Francisco prices at the time. And then came to Kendall here in Chicago and interviewed and had a really nice interview and decided, why not, let's give it a shot. And you know, it's a two-year program. It was, you know, at that time you really don't see the future, and I didn't have any grand vision of, you know, even if I was going to be a chef, what does that mean? What kind of chef? What kind of, you know, none of that even made sense to me. All I did was go to school and did what they told me. Then I started working at a restaurant called Les Plumes, which was an old French restaurant on Halsted, where it's been a couple things since, but a couple guys that worked at Le Francais under Bonchet, and just a great place, and a really, like, formidable year of my life. even though it was kind of part-time. But really made an impact of what fine cooking could be and like really structured both elements and techniques and things like that. So it really kind of made me want to go towards the finer style. And
was there a mentor there? Some guy that, you know, who was the first guide?
It was two guys, and their business name was Happy and Smiley, if that may, you know. And one, Smiley, was the pastry chef and ran the line. And, I mean, talk about hardest working people I ever worked for. You know, I mean, they were there at 10. It was their own business. They closed the place. They cleaned the place. And Grumpy was, he was brutal, you know, but he would just scream at you, and you're kind of like, oh, a jerk. And, you know, but, you know, you did the lobster wrong the first time. You didn't do it wrong the second time. You know what I mean? So it was good. It was kind of, you know, back at the time, it was kind of like, oh, get me out of here. But, you know, again, looking back, I really appreciate, you know, the discipline and kind of the seriousness of the kitchen.
Yeah, Ryan Polis said, you know, he knew he had to go and get his ass kicked by some French chef, and he said, like, Bonche literally used to do that. Would come up from behind and kick him in the kitchen.
You know, and that's... It's a tough thing because I'm very much the opposite to this day in my kitchens, and you know, we have very kind of open, very communicative, very kind of relaxed feeling in our kitchens. But I think you either have or you don't. You know what I mean? And maybe if I had spent 5 years under people like that, maybe I'd be a little bit more of like trying to say, well, you don't deserve this. You're gonna get what I got, and you know, that's more like the European and French and English traditions of just beating up when you're young,
brigades.
And then you work up, and then you get to beat up the guys that come in the door that are 15 and 16. But
well, you know, Graham Elliott Bowles was saying, you know, when he was working for Trotter, it was kind of like Trotter breaks you down and builds you back up.
Yeah.
You know, and he said that was very rigorous, and you know, he did that for a while, and you know, he said he doesn't run his kitchen that way either. You know, he's also very, you know, it's about the communication. And so I think maybe that's something you learn from, but you don't want to propagate that.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And Charlie is a whole different entity unto himself. I mean, and I can appreciate it from an outsider's point of view. I couldn't put up with it, you know, personally. I mean, there's one thing if a French guy is being a jerk and he has been through the entire process and he's here saying, I've been through this, I can understand that. But when someone just basically teaches themselves to cook, and I have respect for his cooking style, but to kind of throw that kind of weight and mental fatigue at people, I think it's a little much. You know what I mean? I think it's a little bit ego driven. I don't get it, but you know, it's gotten where he has, and you know, there's something to be said about that and what he brings to Chicago, which is a good thing. So.
So then you made your way to Trio after.
Yep. Graduated school, made my way to Trio a few years later, and at that job, I was basically just trying to kind of took a cut in pay to go there. Huge cut in pay. It was ridiculous wages, but you know, Rick really was kind of like, I've been here, and here's my portfolio, and this is going to be a great restaurant. And you know, started there as a line cook. Sous chef left 3 months later. I moved up to sous chef. Then maybe chef cuisine a year later. Again, it's just kind of one of those things where I think I just have that. I don't like to work for people, and it's kind of like you try to excel to get to the top. You know what I mean? Because you want to be there. Cause you don't want to like to, you know, have people controlling what you're doing. But you know, that situation really didn't work out well with them, with Rick and Gail and myself, because it was just very different mentalities again of how things were going to be done. And so they left, and I ended up just staying and taking over, and it was there 7.5 years. So
one of the things, I was at the Printer's Row thing you did this with Bayless and Daly, and I think some kid had asked about, you know, what your advice to young chefs were, and I think the one thing you said was, you know, people move up too quickly, or they're, you know, they don't get all the experience they need. And I thought that was interesting since you had moved pretty quickly in the Trio, and I'm curious why you know, were there pressures or things that you didn't fully understand? And
I think it's, you know, I think, and again, it kind of depends on what level, but I've just felt, and I mean, obviously, I was driven to excel and try to figure out something that I needed to figure out, and that was being thrown into kind of a four-star dining environment and how to succeed at that. I've had a lot of people work for me who, you know, obviously didn't work for the wages they wanted to, had some good talent, and took the first sous chef job that kind of floated in front of them for $42,000. And then, you know, I just couldn't, I mean, I could count on both hands the amount of people that kind of regretted it, you know. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the situation worked out for me, and I don't think it's a normal situation. But people's past, and obviously everybody's different, has different goals, but, you know, I really felt like a lot of people took those jobs because they felt pressured to get the money. And then very quickly realize the limitations of that direction, you know what I mean? And then they're, you know, they weren't in fine dining, and they were, you know, there's no money in fine dining, and, you know, that's the bottom line. And if you're, you know, if you can make it through to the end, then who knows, you might do well. But, you know, the process is going to be a tough one. But you learn more, you have more to draw from, you know, you ultimately become a larger picture of everybody you work for, that you create a new product for people. Because if you've only worked for one or two, you're basically emulating their product and you're really not changing much. You may combine those two and it's a little different, but, like, you know, I think the more you have, I think the you know, the bigger product that you can give and more diverse, and, you know, then it's new to the market and then people are learning. You know, you got a Trotter technique in there, you got somebody else's technique, you got a cool way to do it, that, and then plus your style on top of all that. So that's kind of where that comes from. And I guess I always encourage people to, you know, kind of take their time. And it's just, when I started, there was a TV Food Network. There were, you know, obviously the Wolfgang Pucks and the people like that who you, I don't know if you necessarily aspire to, but those are the people that were kind of ruling, you know, the ruling class.
It wasn't a celebrity or chef or
But you knew that there was success at the very top. But you basically saw them as people in their 40s and 50s who had worked a ton and built up, and then all of a sudden the advent of, you know, Emeril and, you know, Todd English and these people that just basically, you know, I'm not saying they didn't work hard, they don't, you know, I'm sure they're very talented, but, you know, they walked into a situation very quickly and were all of a sudden media overexposed millionaires, you know what I mean? And I think that's what's driven a lot of kids to school. I mean, I heard a statistic that culinary school is like the number two business, growing business. I mean, not about, that's just talking about taking kids' money.
Yeah. Where did your style come from? I think, you know, it's kind of interesting because I've been thinking about Chicago, and it's like, you know, on one hand you have, you know, Omaru and, you know, Graham and Grant, and they're doing this, you know, techno,
right.
Mr. Wizard cooking.
Right.
And, you know, I think what's interesting though is the other thing is you have guys like, you know, Paul Kahn,
uh-huh.
and you, and, you know, even like nationally, like I think maybe something like Suzanne Goen, or, you know, where there's this sort of like this simple approach. It's a, you know, like a Zen approach to cooking. Like, I don't know, I was thinking of, what would you call it? Like a nouvelle or something like that. But, you know, where does that come from?
You know, I don't know. I think it's, because my stuff has definitely changed. You know, I mean, I think for people that have been around me probably could say, oh yeah, that's Sean, or that's, you know, and I probably couldn't notice it, but, you know, there's definitely been larger influences in different times. When I started at Trio, I was very much into Asian food, you know what I mean? And I wanted to kind of keep it balanced in there, but really, you know, did bento boxes and things like that. Then that, you know, and then, because that's what I was eating all the time. You know, I love eating sushi, Thai, and, you know, but then you kind of taste change, and then you're kind of like, taste something else, and then next thing you know, you're kind of using the same kind of influencer, you see something. So it's kind of, you know, kind of, I don't know, it incorporates slowly, and, you know, the style kind of goes over. But, you know, and then I look at Paul, and I have Paul's food, and it's, you know, it's amazing sometimes, you know, again, and that's what, when you said that, he's like the epitome of that to me, you know. It makes sense, it's tasty food. It's wholesome, it's, you know, it's a lot of those things, and it just always generally makes sense. It's, you know, he's got a very good way of managing people that cook for him, because things are seasoned properly, which is the hardest thing, is when you're teaching other people to do stuff for you, you know, when you can't do it. And I think that's, you know, which is another subject, but And that's what I aspire to do. And I think at this restaurant, I mean, Paul and, you know, Tom Colicchio at Kraft were like big inspiration, because he does the same thing. And, you know, you go to Kraft and you order a piece of bass or a chicken. That's all you get on the plate. But there's something about it, and it tastes perfect. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, whereas, you know, some place would be like, this is all I got. You know what I mean? Where's the this and that? And,
yeah.
You know, it's, I mean, that's the most simple version. Obviously, Paul's a lot more creative in some of the combinations, but, you know, it's that root of what I would say new American, you know, European new American cooking, which we're trying to do more here, and this is kind of like a new foray for me.
I noticed you guys got the lounge menu, the tasting menu in the lounge.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's a lot of talk about gastropubs and things like that now, but I think it's interesting because, like, with Green Zebra, you were doing the dharma masala popcorn, and you were almost doing some of that, like, amused bar food before anybody else was doing, which is...
Which, you know, and then which create our own things, and we kind of stepped back from that. And it was a fun thing to do, but, you know, it's, you know, it comes with all these little prices to pay, because... It's a fast-paced restaurant.
Yeah.
It's small. It's kind of like, can you have this thing on the table too long? No. But then you try to take it away. People want it. But.
So, I mean, let's talk about that a little bit. You got three places. You know, I think there's been a lot of talk lately about, you know, I think one of the food magazines did a story about, like, Jean Georges and how those places aren't all that great anymore, or, you know, and maybe that's just critics tearing people down, but we've become a chef-driven cuisine, and, you know, when people eat at Custom House or Green Zebra or Spring, they expect Sean McClain's food. But I think Pat Bruno even just did a thing where he said you weren't in the restaurant.
And I was. That's what just pisses me off.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, even more than anything, it's just like, you know, and again, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I...
No, go ahead. I mean, my thing was going to be, you know... you know, how important is that? I mean, it seems like, you know, you're executing that vision and you're watching over that, so.
Well, it's...
Or do you lose something in the process?
I think there's always something, but that's, you know, whether, you know, you can have a 200-seat restaurant and be off one night and lose something. You know, I mean, at some point, you have to realize that, you know, your life is as important to you as your work, you know, and you need to be away from work, you need to do things. So if you have one or two or three, there's going to be a point where you rely on people. And even if you're there, you're relying on people to put the right amount of salt, to make the vinaigrette the same way, to ask you a question if they have, you know, I mean, and maybe they don't. Maybe they just say, I think it's all right, and they send it, and you can't taste it. You're there. And it's a bad thing that went out. It looked okay. It doesn't taste the same. And the guy goes, fuck, I saw Sean and it sucked. You know what I mean? So it's, you know, but, you know, Pat sat on table 21. There's a window. I'm in the window. You can't really see my head and shoulders. We saw the table. We knew the order came in. We basically said, okay, let's just, you know, obviously take care of the food. Send it out. We thought the food was about as good as we can make it. And then you just read the tone of the article, and he starts. You know what I mean? It's not even that he was like, well, I was wondering, or I was whatever. And I thought the biggest disrespectful thing there on that whole article was how he just dishes my chef de cuisine as some name. You know, it's like, he doesn't know who Rich is. Why don't you call me and ask me what his background is, you know? The guy was in Europe 3 years. He was sous chef at Spiaggia. Very talented cook. You know what I mean? It's like... He has some strengths that I don't have, you know what I mean? It's like, let's talk about that. So it's frustrating.
Yeah.
It's to me, it's a small town mentality. It's a mentality where, you know, and I've always said, you know, you can have a business, you know, producing something, and people always want you to expand, do well, entrepreneurship. As soon as you own a restaurant, people are like, no, where are you going? Don't expand, don't do anything different, you know what I mean? And it's a really double standard for business.
Yeah.
I've kind of just come to the conclusion that it, you know, the bottom line is it's a family and it's a business, and we're going to do the best we can. We're going to make mistakes, and that's inevitable no matter whether I'm here every day or not. We're going to make mistakes. We try to minimize them, but we try to keep the vision clear. We try to make it, you know, an environment that everybody's enjoying themselves in. And hopefully most of the customers will get it, because if everything's executed perfectly, there's still going to be 2-5% of people that walk in there and go, I don't get it. I didn't like it. okay, I understand, you know what I mean? But those are the people that are writing a lot more now, you know, and having more, you know, input on people, public opinion, because they have the ability now to write in a public forum, so.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I think one of the things I've heard, you know, just recently is how, you know, I've heard, like, Chicago Magazine's been thinking about changing their format since Time Out came on the scene, and that's because, you know, Time Out's been kind of, you know, snarky, and, like, you know, they're getting a lot more people, and, you know, and it's like, you almost wonder if there's a competition there just to be more of an entertainment venue for food rather than actually exploring what the food's about.
Yep, absolutely, and, I mean, Time Out was very good to us, in general, has been very good to us, but they've also been pretty brutal. Some and friends I have, and, you know, I don't know, it's a fine line, you know, it's you put yourself up for, you know, something about the business is warranted, whether it's the media attention, I guess, you really you know, solicit a lot of opinions, you know, you don't judge your dentist, you don't write blogs about,
right,
you know,
not yet,
not yet, about, you know, how the care was, and, you know, if you waited the doctor for 15 minutes, do you think twice? No. You wait at a restaurant 15 minutes, you want a free drink, you want, you know, it's like...
I wouldn't take a free root canal.
don't put me under.
That's all right. I'll pay. So you're on death row. What do you eat for your last meal?
Oh, man. Well, French fries would have to be included somewhere. that's definitely my downfall.
Thank you.
French fries... You know, it's tough because I guess in a way it's almost like it's like the ultimate pig outfit. You know, I mean, it's like something where you just get so much satisfaction from, you know, pizza. But then you're like, great, you know, Ocetra caviar would be awesome. Bala Krug. But then I think of, like, do you know Dean Zanella from 312 Restaurant?
I know.
He's a great guy.
Is he?
But, yeah, he's a friend of mine. And he has his mom's meatball recipe that he'll bring to the, like, we have chef meeting or, like, meetings. It means we get together and drink. But he'll bring them out. You know, it's just a snack on. They're so good. Something like that. You know, really down home. But there's nothing, like, love to say there was something I grew up with that I just... But I grew up with some crap food.
Yeah.
You know, family never cooked, and mom didn't really know how to do anything, so it was a lot of casseroles and overcooked whatever it was, you know.
Yeah, I think it's pretty typical.
Yeah.
You have any favorite French fries? Some French fries that you dream of or that you've had?
No. I don't know. My mom got me hooked on French fries. I mean, not that I eat it all the time, but French fries and mayonnaise.
Yeah. I love Hop Leaf. They have the garlic aioli and the mussels. Oh, man, that's good. With a little Belgian beer.
Yeah. That's
a favorite for me.
That's so tasty.
How did you hook up with Peter and Sue?
I was at Trio kind of formulating my departure. Kind of figuring out what I wanted to do and just kind of starting the initial. And Sue was maitre d' there. Peter at the time was working for a place called Hudson Club, which is where Sushi Samba is now. And didn't really know him very well, but, you know, got to know Sue pretty well and really kind of had a, really just liked her style. And I think her and I, we were a similar age. And said, I think, had very common kind of goals and interests in the industry. So I just kind of asked her, you know, if she'd be interested in doing it, and said she'd love to. And then Peter, actually, his boss at Hudson Club owned the bathhouse that Spring is in. So that's kind of how the whole space came available. And then he was departing from them, and so he was, you know, he said, well, let's just all do this. So that's kind of where it started. And but it's, I mean, the one nice, or the greatest thing about it is just the fact that it's, you know, Sue has always been predominantly front of the house, wine, and Peter has always generally done bookkeeping, general manager kind of thing. So it's, you know, and I'm the kitchen, and you know, in this business, it's really hard to find a partnership where someone's kind of, you know, you're either both the same or you're, you know, two opposite. And, you know, this way it was real like the, just the...
Yeah, like Saltus just had that big falling out, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, that's Michael, too bad. And, yeah. Too bad. I liked the restaurant. I mean, I was... I don't know how much the food's changed since he left. I went in a couple times when it was his menu. He wasn't there, but I like the space. The guy is very nice. Mm-hmm. He owns it. He's very energetic and happy. And
I took an entrepreneurial class at DePaul last year, and I can't tell you how many guest speakers emphasized. They were like, don't go into partnership. You know, it's like, because in some ways they always talk about it. It's you're just compensating for your weaknesses, and you can hire for your weaknesses, and they always end up worse than divorces. That was what everybody was always saying. But then again, I mean, it seems like you have a good partnership. And
yeah, you know, it's it has its days. You know, it's a marriage.
Sure.
And when things are going well, and everybody's getting taken care of, there, you know, the problems seem to go away. When things get tough, that's when, you know, and we're going through a big growing period right now. And we really never had a vision of having three restaurants. They all kind of came up very independently and very serendipitously, you know what I mean, through contacts and presented opportunities I thought were just really hard to pass up, you know. It wasn't that we were kind of out there hungry for, like, let's find a space to do this, you know. It was kind of one of those things. And but now, you know, I mean, honestly, spring is struggling, you know what I mean, because it's going through that fourth year, you know, identity crisis, and, you know, it had such an amazing start, and I still believe the food is outstanding. I think Darren does an unbelievable job there.
There's some competition from your protégés now, right?
There's competition. There's, you know, the restaurant's not brand new anymore. It's start, you know what I mean? It's just like people... they see it, and it's really hard. That's why, you know, I applaud Blackbird. And, I think, you know, location has some things to do with it. That's part of the puzzle. It's not the whole puzzle. I think it's hurt us a bit, you know, ultimately, because it's not a neighborhood restaurant. It never really has been. You know, we can't automatically make it a neighborhood restaurant. I think there's things we can do, and we're actually kind of in the process right now of doing a reevaluation of kind of where we want to select. I think we're going to kind of maybe relaunch spring, you know, in a couple months. And I think we're going to kind of go back to where we started with, and that's kind of more of the Asian stuff to it, and maybe incorporate, maybe go a little further into that, and do a lot more app-heavy menu, you know, cool dumplings, cool, you know, interpretations of seafood like that. That's a little bit more approachable. That'll be $7, $8, $9 instead of, you know, where we're at now, where we're charging $10, $11, $12, $13, $14.
I like that approach, though. I mean, one of the things I've been thinking about is, you know, you got all these big French guys like Ducasse, and, you know, they had their 3-star Michelins, but now they're coming down and they're doing things like Spoon and, you know, these lower end things, and you know, it's. There's a guy I was reading about in Portland, I think Michael Heberoy, who's doing like a 3-course prefix, $30, $35, and, you know, just kind of making this kind of food more accessible. I know the economics are tough sometimes, but, you know, I think, you know, more good chefs like you did that kind of thing. I think, you know, I think it's better in general in terms of I think more people will come out. You know? You can serve a dining room of 1,000 and do it well. You know, I know that's a logistical issue but, you know.
Well, it's tough. I mean, and what we're finding now, too, is, I mean, when I talk to people on the street, the people that, you know, either haven't been to Spring yet, haven't been in a while, they're just like, well, how long is it going to take me to get a reservation? It's like, call. You know, you'd be surprised. But, you know, it's a thing that happened at Trio, too, and it's a phenomenon that I tried to stay away from in Spring early on, but it was just too difficult because it was such a demand. But, you know, Trio went through this thing where it was a very hard ticket to get, you know, the first year and a half, 2 years. And people get tired of calling, you know, they give up. And they still think, so they still see it in the press, or they still think it's the same way, they don't call anymore. And, you know, had they called, they'd be in, or they, you know what I mean, they could have a 7:30 on a Thursday, or, you know, Saturdays are still the ones, the tough ones, but...
Yeah, and there's something about growing small, I think. You know, you look at, like, musicians, like somebody like an Ani DeFranco or something who never signed with a major label, and they just went from town to town and got bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
And they're always going to have that group of people with them, whereas, like, if you hit with a big, like, restaurant article in the New York Times, everybody comes in, you know, but then what happens after that if you, you know, you don't have, like, this base, you know, I don't know.
It's very true, and we got a New York Times article for Zebra, and, I mean, the response there has been really good. It's a small place, so it fills up easily, so it's not, you know, a 100-seat dining room that we're trying to fill every night. Sometimes I wish it was. You know, the economics of that venture are, you know, obviously hindsight 2020. You know, the place is too small. It's too labor-intensive. You know, it's too top-heavy just to produce it. And it makes no money, you know. It's kind of like, it's really hard to project a year of working hard to break even, you know what I mean? And
I know there was some concern, or maybe not on your part, but I think people have talked about, you know, how are you going to get through the winters with seasonality?
Oh, yeah.
How's that been for you guys?
It's, you know, it's tough, but I think, you know, I've always been under... My opening chef, Michael, and I differed on some points, and he was very good. He still is a close friend of mine. And I really allowed him to make some big decisions early on about kind of how he wanted to do the daily menu, and I understood that. And he went one extreme, which was basically getting nothing but what he could find here. And the bottom line is, it's impossible, it's boring, and people need more. The menu got cut in half, and, you know, since Christine's taken over, it's like a balancing act now, and we can still find great, mostly organic stuff from Southern California. It's beautiful, you know what I mean? We get fresh heart of palm flown in from Hawaii.
I see it's some Casa Verde.
What's that?
Casa Verde heirloom tomatoes or something like that was on the menu or something.
Oh,
like
you
that?
Know what? Those were probably preserved.
Okay.
Yeah, we did some canning. Yeah, we did some canning and stuff. But there's a balance of stuff, and I'm not saying strawberries, tomatoes, you know, things that really shout different seasons. But there are things you can do year round. You know, I mean, not necessarily year round, but there's things to fill in, and so. You know, I've kind of impressed upon her that, you know, it was never my intention with that restaurant to be 100% organic. If we get close, great. I mean, that's a plus. I never said we're going to only buy from local farmers. When we can, great. You know, let's do everything we can. But, you know, it's a business. It's food. You know, I mean, let's have fun with it. You know, the people come in here want to be... You know, they want good food, you know what I mean? They want it to taste good, they want it to be, you know what I mean? And if everything else is in line, you know, that's all great. And it's a balancing act right now. But, you know, the menu is a little bit more monochromatic right now, for sure, this time of year. But, you know, in the spring and summer, it's like, God, you can do twice the menu. There's just, you know, it's kind of unfair because it's an explosion of everything. Then you try to, you know, it's hard to incorporate all that stuff, but... But it's working out, and I really, you know, Christine is, she's awesome.
Yeah.
Really is good with, you know, we just have a very good relationship. Actually, I have a great relationship, her and Darren, which is great, because we can sit down, and I'll just throw out ideas, and she'll be like, kind of takes them in, then she'll write them down, then she'll kind of come back a little bit, and then I'll just say, there, and then, you know, and then the last... 50%, 40%, 30%. She executes, she takes care of, she tweaks, she does, and she may say, well, I had to drop this, I had to add it. But she makes those decisions, and the it's kind of like, it feels good for me because I feel like there's input there. It feels good for her because she's really kind of realizing it, you know, from start to finish in a way. And, you know, it's very, you know, because it'd be hard, you know, sometimes it would be hard. You know, when I worked at Trio and Rick was departing to do Brasserie Tea at the time, one, I didn't get along with him very well, which was not a good start. But, you know, he would be like, well, if you can do anything, I want to taste it, you know, before you put it on. And I don't trust you, basically, was what he was saying. And I was just like, no.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I don't.
It's like no micromanaging.
Yeah. And that's ultimately kind of what led to the split of the...
That's why I'm doing a food website myself.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Yep. No, it is true, and I would have to probably agree with the partnership thing then too. And, you know, who knows what the future will hold? You know, in the beginning, all you want to do is open a restaurant. That's all you care about. You know, and then you kind of realize, wow, we're hitched. You know, financially, emotionally, you know, a lot of different ways. And, you know, everything will work out.
Is there something you want to do that you can't do in a partnership? But is there a vision you have?
No, I think it's maybe just. I mean, I think it's maybe just styles of management. Obviously, I have no vision. The only thing I have kind of sitting out there right now is to maybe do a book for Green Zebra, which I think would be the best opportunity because I think it's the more unusual. There's
some great dishes there.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I think, a good, unique, it's very hard to find something like that. You know, maybe little parts of it, but as a whole, I don't think there's much out there, and especially when it comes to books, not that
sure.
I've seen, you know, and that's hard to say when it comes to books, because, you know,
yeah,
everything has been, oh.
Yeah, I think in that world, I think you have, like, you know, your substitute-type vegetarian cooking, like seitan and those
yep,
kind of things.
Yep.
And then you have maybe more, like, a very pure approach, like Deborah Madison or something
that.
But yours is, you know, I think it's somewhere in the middle of those, you know? And that's what I've always liked about this. You guys kind of eschewed the substitutes and went for, you know, pure product, which I thought was great.
Yeah, the products are just weird. I mean, tofu, again, aside, I have this side to me that likes those things. And you make dressings with it or you accent something with it, but to just put a slab out just to say, here's your pro, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, you know,
here's your
it's
mom
not
texture.
That good. It's not that good.
Something that tastes like whatever's on it can't be that good.
Yeah, it's weird stuff. But, you know, when I order, like, a lot of, you know, Thai or whatever kind of that has, I'll always order with tofu.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I guess it's a vision. I think I'm eating healthy. You know, I don't know whether it's true. Or, you know, right after I eat French fries or something. You know what I mean? But,
so you're still big into Asian then? Or?
You know, I go back and forth. You know, for a while there too, I was like, you know, very interested in like Indian and kind of that Middle Eastern stuff too, which I think it's cool just because of the, I mean, it's just you can really alter through the spice selection, you know what I mean? And I'm not a heat guy, you know what I mean? I like a little chili now and again, but I don't like hot food. But there's just so many spices. And there was a woman who wrote a cookbook from Australia. She did a luncheon at Trotters I got to go to. But she has a book out called Spice. And but just, you know, everything homemade, you know, I mean, all her masalas and everything, and just the half the book is just, but it's interesting because you get so many different profiles and you add those into some kind of puree or fat or something, you know what I mean? It's just something completely different, and you season it properly, and then all of a sudden you have something different. And I think, like, Michael Taos kind of tries to do that, and I haven't had his food in a while, I'm just reading his menus, but I think what his biggest downfall was describing his food too much. And people were like, oh my God. Instead of just letting it speak for itself and saying, kind of hit the highlights, and maybe just saying an overall masala or curry scent or something, but instead he's kind of got it, like, he really pulls out the strangeness of the words, which I think throw people off, and I think that's what, you know, I think if he took out half the wording of this menu, it would be, I think he'd do better. And I don't know. I mean, that's just...
Well, you know, it's funny, though, because actually on my way over here, or before I was coming over, I was looking at some of your menus lately just to see what you were doing. And one of the things, and I remember even having this experience when I've eaten at Green Zebra in spring, I love the way your menus are written.
Yeah.
You know, I think it is an art form. I think, you know, what do you put in, what don't you, you know? And
right.
I was looking at Graham Elliott Bowles, what he's doing at Avenues right now, and he's got sort of like these four or five tastings, and it's just like the elements exactly, and I think maybe that's gone too far, because now you don't know what you're getting unless you have to go and look over on the tasting menu and see, oh yeah, that's what trout roe egg means, whereas, you know, I think you strike a good balance between a little bit of description, but also, you know, the purity of the ingredients themselves.
Yeah, I would agree, and I mean, see, they all kind of read differently, all the menus, but I think it's like, there has to be an element of style, like you say, a little bit austere, you know, I mean, like, don't exactly know, but you gotta, I mean, obviously you gotta cover your bases so people go, oh my god,
yeah,
what's in here that I didn't know? But yeah, it's tricky. It's definitely tricky, but I like the simple, and just, you know, you catch those words that are just the, you know, which I thought we did here on the opening menu, and I think we're, I mean, we're switching around, but just the subtle words that catch in there, like that kind of draw you in or whatever.
Do you actually write your menus?
Yeah. Yeah. I do, and I, you know, I'm a procrastinator by nature, always have been. I wrote Zebra's menu basically 3 days before we did our practice dinners, you know what I mean, and much to the, you know, disbelief of all the cooks, and it was very challenging, but it's one of those things, I just wasn't ready, and then I just did it, and I stayed up all night and did it, and once I did it, I felt good about it. And most of that opening menu didn't work all completely. It sounded great, but it didn't work completely. We had to make adjustments. And same with Custom House. You know, everybody always waits for me. I did my schoolwork like that. I did my college papers like that. I just last minute sit down, concentrate, and say, in order to pass this, you have to do this. And there's no, you can't go to sleep. You can't go, you know.
Sometimes pressure's a good catalyst.
But that's, yeah, I think I thrive under it. I think that's the only thing that drives me sometimes, but
great. I'm all set.
Yeah?
Yeah, so I appreciate you doing this.
Absolutely. Well, I'd love to, you know, let me know if you're gonna come to dinner. I'd love to, you know, if I can be there, great. If not, but just,
yeah,
I'd love to make the reservation for
you. Because I'll probably just write a, you know, a review about how you weren't in the kitchen.
Son of a bitch.
Sean told me he was going to be there, but he wasn't, so I was doubly pissed.
I just, we're gonna, we joke about like a little cutout in the window, I just kind of go right by.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens, you know, it's just, I mean, and you brought up that thing about John George, and there's a writer who I had a bad experience with from, he writes for GQ, and he writes for, GQ?
Alan Richmond.
And, Alan Richmond needs to be put to pasture as far as I'm concerned when it comes to food writing, because at some point you are neither independent, you are neither objective because of your, you know, I mean, I applaud the fact that he's been able to eat around the world and eat at the finest restaurants in the world. But at some point that's going to skew your ability to react to contemporary approaches and different things. And he wrote a scathing one about John George saying, where's this guy gone? He has all this. And, you know, I mean, I would put John George's, any one of his restaurants against most of anything in the country. You know what I mean? John George, that's the cream of the crop. Vong, unbelievable restaurant. I mean, that's one of 15 restaurants. It's a great restaurant. Mm-hmm. It would stack up against any restaurant like that. But just to call the fact that a chef owner is you know what I mean? I just really felt it was unfair.
You think it's conceptually based rather than in practice?
Oh, absolutely.
He's like, well, you can't have 15 places and have 15 good restaurants.
Yeah, exactly. And I just really thought it was unfair. And he came and ate at Spring, and unfortunately, you know, I would recognize him. I wasn't in the dining room, but he had dinner there, and you know, we do primarily seafood. That's our specialty there. He orders the beef or the meat, which is whatever. That's why we had on the menu. He was the grumpiest guy at the door. I mean, I went through the whole scenario after I found out he was eating there, or found out he gave his card to somebody at the end. The way he gave the card was just to say, I'm not hungry.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was completely grumpy at the door. He was kind of just like an old, like, jerky guy, you know, by himself. And the hostesses were like, what can I do? You know, whatever. He eats by himself. So we get a call. And we think, well, we hope you had a good time, whatever. We had the manager talk to him. So he gives us a call and said, oh, we really want to include you in an article in GQ. And we're like, oh, fantastic. So, well, we need to do this hurry-up photo shoot. We need all this stuff for this photo shoot. And then I wake up at 8 o'clock, go do this photo shoot and all this stuff. And he fucking beats us up in the article. It's like, why the fuck would you do that to me, you know?
Like, why would you want to take pictures if you were
just... you know, make me look like an ass, you know what I mean? It's like... Oh, that just killed me. So ever since then, it's just like, you know, I'm always leery about stuff like that, especially him, and knowing, you know, he could be just brutal, you know.
Yeah.
And just, like I said, it just sometimes, and he was, he wrote an article about Bocuse, too, that was the same way. He's kind of like, give the guy credit, man. Let him relax, live his life and live on, you know what I mean? I guarantee his restaurant's still great. You know, it is what it is. It's not contemporary. It's never going to be, you know, Gagné or Ducasse or any of these guys who are, you know, cutting a new edge in French cuisine, but it's, he's like the fucking grand, you know, whatever, the top guy. Yeah. It was just, you know, I just thought it was a really cheap shot at him. Just because he went there and felt like things were like, wow.
Yeah. All you can do is execute your vision and, you know, hopefully it's good enough.
Exactly. And I'm sure Bocuse would laugh at him. Just like,
yeah, I'm sure he's not
yeah,
losing.
Yeah,
yeah. I'm sure.
I don't need you. That's for sure.
He's like, I invented, like,
yeah.
a lot of cuisine.
Yeah.
I'm not
you're here because of me, you know. All right.
Good
very
to
nice
meet
to
you,
meet Sean. You. It's a nice chat.
This ends this culinary podcast for Hungry Magazine. Check out www.hungrymag.com for more. Three, two.